Live and Lansing, Jack Ebling is on More Compelling Talk Radio, 1320 WILS.
Welcome back. Jack Ebling here with my co-host, Kelly Rossman McKinney of the Rossman Group, Ebling and You, 1320 WILS. Kel, what did we learn Tuesday night?
What did we learn? Well, you know, here's what we learned, I think we've known this all along. When the voters are not happy with their circumstances, they vote whoever's in charge out of office, or they reach out and touch whoever is closest. Mm-hmm. This was really a vote about the economy.
Yeah.
It was a vote of dissatisfaction with pretty much everybody governmental. And it was really a huge Republican. Mm-hmm. Somebody referred to it at an event I was at yesterday as a Republican bloodbath. And it must be true, because even Diane Byron, former state senator and state rep, was wearing red at this event I was at yesterday. And I thought, oh, boy, nothing says convert.
I heard it referred to as the Crimson Tide, maybe a playoff athletic.
Yep, so. I've heard the Crimson Tide drowns all Democrats.
Everyone expected the pendulum to swing back, but I don't think it expected to hit the Democrats right in the temple the way it did. Want to bring in our first guest today and a regular contributor to this show at 5:08 on Friday, and that is Bill Ballinger, the editor of Inside Michigan Politics. Hello, Bill.
Hey, Jack. How are you?
Just fine. Now, you have seen enough of these cycles and swings. What do we make of this? What can we interpret from it?
Well, this was massive. You know, Kelly is right that in the last few years, it doesn't take long for people to get disgusted with their office holders, whoever they are. I mean, look what's happened here in Michigan. Who could have believed that 2 years ago produced the result that it did here in Michigan with the Obama victory and Democrats, you know, elected up and down the ticket? Same thing 2 years earlier, 2006. This was a huge backlash, I think, starting as a rebuke to George Bush and the National Republicans. It took two election cycles for people to purge themselves of that venom, and now 2 years later they are purging themselves of a new kind of venom and deciding that what they're seeing in Washington isn't what they like, and they kind of tie it here in Michigan, I think, to Jennifer Granholm. Unfortunately for her, leaves office with record low approval and job rating, and the State House of Representatives are controlled by the Democrats. And so I think people just decided, particularly independent voters and ticket splitters who had voted for Democrats by and large in 06 and 08, they shifted massively to the Republicans this time. Republicans were angry, got their voters out this time, and Democrats were dispirited. They just did not turn out. The election turnout this year was down 600,000 from 4 years ago. And the bottom line is, this was the biggest blowout win for the Republicans since the year after World War II ended, 1946. This was bigger than 1994. It was bigger than 1966, which I remember was a huge year when George Romney ran for his third term as governor. It was bigger than all those, bigger than the Eisenhower landslide years of the 1950s. The Republicans just swept the board.
I love a man who knows his history.
That was really good. That was like taking a class.
Thanks, Bill. Now, Bill, is it true that the turnout was particularly low in Detroit?
Not particularly low. Look,
okay.
It's always lower in Detroit than it is outstate.
Yeah.
And let me just put this in a little more context. 4 years ago was actually a huge non-presidential year turnout. It was 3.8 million, and that was 52% of the vote. Now, that is a big non-presidential year turnout in Michigan. This year's turnout was really almost exactly the same as it was 8 years ago, and in 1998 and in 1994. So 94, 98, 2002, 2010, the turnout was all between 43% and 45%, and it was, you know, roughly 3.2 or 3.3 million people. 06, 4 years ago, was particularly large. That was the Granholm DeVos race, non-presidential year, but there was a big national backlash against Bush, and I think maybe that got a lot of people out. And so that was a big, high turnout. But the others were all pretty much the same as this year.
Bill, in your mind, how much of this is a tribute to Rick Snyder, a referendum on Virge Bernero, or was just this just a tie that no individual candidate could have stopped or helped?
I think the latter of the three, or the last of the three possibilities that you raised. And we heard a lot of this yesterday at what we call the Pundit Summit that we always stage 2 days after the election. Kelly Rossman was one of the moderators. You did a great job, Kelly.
Thank you.
And, you know, we heard right out of the box, these guys were saying the election was over after the primary. It was like things were frozen in place on August 3rd. Snyder, once he won the nomination by a bigger than expected margin of about 9%, was immediately shown to be way ahead in the polls, roughly 20% a week after the election. And it basically stayed that way the entire time. I mean, there were some polls that showed him as much as 25 or 27. There were others as low as 12 or 14. But the average over the last 3 months was about 18 to 20%, and I think he won by 18, 19%. I don't think there was anything that Bernero could have done that would have gotten him, you know, victory. Certainly he could never have won. He might have gotten closer by doing a few things differently, but I really don't think so.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The Pundit Summit that Bill was referring to, there were a number of political junkies who were presenters on panels, and one of the folks whose comment I was most intrigued by was Matt Rush with Rush Strategies, formerly worked for, I believe, both Engler and the House Republicans. He said that, you know, obviously, those of us who live and work in Lansing sort of live and breathe this stuff, but for the average folk, they really aren't paying attention until about the last 48 hours before the election. And he said that his own observation with the candidates that he worked with was that their websites would have 40, 50 hits a day until the last 48 hours, and then suddenly it was 500 hits a day. And it made you realize that those last couple of days in particular meant a great deal. But what it didn't take into account, I think, is the general sort of climate or demeanor of the voters. And Bill, I think you're right. Snyder won with such a strong victory in August that, and then September was so quiet for the most part that, gosh, you got into October and it was almost as if it was I wouldn't say anointed. I don't know that you anoint a nerd, although that's a nice, that's got a nice little ring to it. Anoint a nerd.
Anoint a nerd. I like that.
But it was really interesting to hear different people's perspectives. And actually, I thought the most, another great observation, this was not on the gubernatorial campaign, but I think the consensus in general was the best, most effective television ad was the Supreme Court ad for Bob Young and Mary Beth Kelly, where it was a number of folks who were simply saying Young and Kelly, Kelly and Young. Yeah. And it was a great example of that name ID repetition, which Bernero could have benefited from had he done that. But that's not what he did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to ask both of you, I will start with you, Bill. If the primaries had yielded a Mike Cox, Andy Dillon gubernatorial race, where the Democrat was seen as more moderate and the Republican was seen by some as a more extreme, would that have mattered?
I think it would have mattered, I think it would have been a heck of a lot closer a race. I don't think there's any question about that. Whether Dillon could have won in this climate, that remains to be seen. I think he still would have been, you know, swimming against the current, but he had the demeanor, he had the ideological profile to be, I think, a much better Democratic nominee than Bernero. I always thought that.
Yeah,
I thought his big challenge was always, could he ever get through a primary?
Yeah.
And we know what happened there.
He would have been directly tied to what's happened in Lansing, too.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Some folks would laugh and say, gee, Mike Cox, Andy Dillon, same guys, different party in terms of Andy is much more like Rick Snyder. Mm-hmm. Mike Cox is much more like Virge Bernero in terms of personality and demeanor.
Yeah.
The issue that Andy was weak on in the primary, very, very weak, and that was the pro-choice, pro-life issue.
Right.
That would not have been an issue in the general election at all. So those independents who would not have voted for Andy in a primary, those pro-choice Democrats who would not vote for Andy in a primary would definitely have been there for him in a general. So it would be really interesting. But again, as Bill said, not sure that given the huge national wave and sentiment, it would have made that much difference.
Bill, I wanted to ask you in terms of one other race, and we heard as the election neared that Mark Schauer had overtaken Tim Walberg, that he was building his lead. We heard it was 6, 7, 8 points at some.
You're talking about the polls the last week.
Yeah,
we're talking
about those late polls.
Those polls were just plain wrong.
Wrong.
They
across the board,
polls.
I might add. Yeah, I think all of us were wrong.
Yeah, they just were way off. And that really was kind of surprising because Walberg won by a fairly substantial margin. I mean, it wasn't even that close.
Right. You know, it's interesting. I talked to somebody outside the political arena. I do that once in a while. And they were commenting about how much they disliked the Mark Schauer ad that ran the last week or two, where it says, you know, I think Tim Walberg and I can agree on, you know, the nastiness of the campaign, et cetera.
But here's some more nastiness.
And they were kind of turned off by that.
Yeah.
You know, I got to tell you what it showed is, first of all, polls are a snapshot, and it showed that the electorate really was pretty fickle in a couple of arenas. We actually did a poll in mid-September that showed John Dingell very vulnerable, and that poll got a great deal of national attention, something I hadn't expected. And I had a conversation with Debbie Dingell yesterday, who was not happy with me or the poll at all.
You were right.
And he was certainly vulnerable, and I didn't say this to Debbie, but I believe that our poll results were accurate at that time. What I also think is that it was a swift kick in the butt to someone who had been in the past a pretty laissez-faire campaigner.
Might have saved him.
Yeah, I think that it certainly ginned up the campaign, but that wasn't a conversation I was willing to have with Debbie when she was in her feisty mode right in front of me. But I did. I want you to know, Bill, thank you very much, that I did go up and initiate the conversation. And her first words were, I am furious with you. I am still furious with you.
So you got a frosty response?
Yeah, but you know, I love a woman who is so absolutely devoted to her man.
Yeah, well,
I love that about Debbie.
Yeah.
And she was right. She had every right to be furious.
Well, listen, anytime the Dingles win by less than 70%, Debbie gets a nosebleed. So, you know, I think, let's put it this way, you got their attention. Actually, maybe you did them a favor. You
absolutely
know, I mean, seriously, they might have coasted along.
Would you put that in writing?
And there could have been a wave, you know. She was yelling and moaning out in the hall outside the conference about terrible polling. Now, she was really griping about polling. She claimed she's doing her PhD thesis on polling. Debbie, how long have you been working on this thesis?
Yeah, she said I gave her dissertation, and I said, well, I'm happy to apply.
I think it's 20 years in the making, and I think maybe when the polls are going right, she kind of puts the thesis aside.
She has a lot of election cycles to sample with her husband, I'll tell you. No question
about
that.
Well, and you know what? Can I just say, in great defense of both Debbie and John Dingell, I have the greatest admiration for them, and it is my fervor and hope that when he retires, that Debbie steps into that seat. I think she would be a fabulous congresswoman.
It's my hope that he retires and doesn't get ousted.
What about Chris Dingell?
Well, Chris,
he is a judge, and he's a former state senator. He's John's.
You know
son.
That.
You know, I asked John Dingell a couple of years ago. I said, "Now tell me, Congressman, when you retire, who is going to who is going to succeed you?" And he looked at me and he said, "I'll guarantee you one thing: it'll be a Dingell."
We know that much.
He Bill wouldn't go any farther than that. That's Bill, all he said.
Bill Ballinger, the editor of Inside Michigan Politics, our guest. Bill, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks, right. Bill.